So, we're still working our way through Deuteronomy, and today we're on Deuteronomy chapter 20. Again, that's Deuteronomy chapter 20. You have Bibles on your phones. We have Bibles back there. If you do not have a Bible, we have more than you could ever need here at church. But we're opening up Deuteronomy chapter 20. I'm going to be using the English Standard Version. It's the version I'm most comfortable with. But feel free to use whatever translation you'd like. So, for those of you that don't know, before I was your boy, Vicar Stephen, I was a private panel and also sergeant panel. I was in the military, and I went to basic training in Oklahoma, and when I got out of basic training, they came to us and told us about all these programs that we could get part of. There was fishing clubs, there was car clubs, and one of them was Warrior Fitness. You know, run faster, eat better, stop drinking so much. Usual things they tell soldiers, right? But when I heard it, I had this visceral, immediate, negative reaction. I heard it and I hated it. I didn't know why. So I got to thinking. I sat down and I thought, why don't I like this program? And I realized it's because of the word, war, and things that word in my mind conjured up image of Conan the Barbarian, conjured up image of a blood-crazed berserker, going and killing and being taken away in the heat of passion of battle. And that wasn't who I wanted to be. I didn't want to be a warrior. I wanted to be a soldier. I wanted everything. I wanted the pressed green uniform I spent entire paycheck on. I wanted a well-functioning M4. I wanted a well-maintained truck that still managed to break down in the way. But I wanted to be a soldier, not a warrior. So in Deuteronomy chapter 20, this is preparation for the Holy War to take the promised land. And we'll see that God wants soldiers, not warriors. So what makes a soldier? Stands, rules. A soldier trusts in his commander and follows the rules and precepts that he sets out. A warrior does what he wishes. So we begin in verse 1. When you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. So a few things here. Chariots, horses. These were things that Israel didn't have. Partially because they were wandering around in the wilderness, and partially because horses and chariots were the equivalent of tank nowadays. Very expensive, hard to maintain, a sign of wealth and prestige, and those things were like pounds. But here, God proclaims the Gospels, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you. What do you have to fear? Sure, these chariots might run you down, but you've already won the battle. God is with you. God is fighting alongside of you. And he says, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt? Do you remember what that was like, says God? When you put one foot in the Red Sea and it parted? When I threw the Pharaoh's horses and chariots into the sea and swallowed them up? Remember those great things I did for you then? Think about what I can do for you now. So, the army is assembled. First, the priests get a crack at them in verse 2 through 4. And when you draw near to the battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people and say to them, hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for the battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or weep and dread them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you the victory. So again, here the priest comes and he proclaims the gospel to the gospel is not a new invention. The gospel is not something confined to the gospels. It is the whole arc of the Bible. It is the whole point of the Bible, this gospel, that your God is with you, fighting with you, giving you the victory. But he still calls for his people to fight. He still calls for good works. I was once with an Orthodox priest, and we got to talking, and he said, why do we do good works? We do good works like a child offering up to their father, gift. That gift was bought with his own money, made by his own hands, but he still delights in that gift because it shows that child's love for him. Those are our good works from God, to God. We offer up these deeds, these actions, this fighting to him, even though he's won the victory, even though it is by his hand we do those good works. And God, being our good Father, delights in them, loves them. So, good works, we can't rely on them. But I rely on good works. So many of us rely on good works to not only save ourselves, but improve ourselves. For my generation, social media. We go on there and we see some man saying, here, I can make you great. I can give you an amazing car. I can give you an amazing life. Just take my class. Just give me a little bit of money and I'll tell you how to do it. And then when you do it, you lose the goalposts. That life you have isn't pretty enough. That car isn't fast enough. That paycheck you have doesn't have enough zeros at the end. Just give me a little bit more and I'll tell you what to do. Give me a little bit more and a little bit more, and he takes and the devil takes and takes. So thank God it's not us that's winning this battle. Thank God it's not our works that are achieving this, but no, it is God that gives the victory. So the soldiers are assembled. The priest has talked to them. Now the officers get their crack at them, and we see what kind of soldiers God wants in verses 5 through 7. Then the officers shall speak to the people, saying, is there any man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And is there any man who has planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed his fruit? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man enjoy his fruit. And is there any man who is betrothed to wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her. So these are draft exemptions. So, who here is a male between 18 and 25? Raise your hands. Have you registered for selective service? Legally, yes? Yes? Maybe. All right, I got surprised. The Fullerton PD is here now as a state operator. Kill us! Well, you didn't even get up the run. But these are draft exemptions, and this is a draft for the war against for the Holy Land. All the people of Israel are participating. These aren't professional soldiers. These are common people. So when I was about to turn 18, my dad kept on talking about, we're going to have to register you for selective service. When you turn 18, we're registering you for selective service because you had to do it online. It wasn't automatic back then. And because he had it written on his heart that to honor his father and mother wasn't just about honoring grandma and, well, just grandma, grandpa wasn't around, but it was about being part of a society. You have to obey by its rules. You have to participate in it. And sometimes that means paying your taxes. Sometimes it means not jaywalking. Sometimes it means going to war. And that draft, that war for him, was part of it. My uncle beat the draft by just a day. I'm sure we know friends or family, brothers, sisters, grandpas, who were affected by the draft, who had their lives disrupted by war. And as long as there has been a draft, there have been draft exemptions. The first ones that I know about were for the communities who would later become the Amish. They went to President Lincoln during the Civil War and said, we abhor violence. We don't want a part in this war. We just want to live on our farms peacefully and have a good life. And so Lincoln said back to them, we need regiments of men like you. And he granted the exemptions because he knew that being alive was more than just war. Yes. Okay.
But
a handheld mic.
Yeah.
All right. Hello? Can you hear me now?
I'll ask him.
Okay. Up there in the box, can they hear me now? No? Okay. We try. At Searchlight, we pivot. They still have some sound, don't we? Some sound?
Going out online?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm listening to it.
Yeah, we have sound. Anyway, back to the service at hand, but thank you for that. The people online are just as much part of the service as us here in person, and they deserve a very good service. They deserve good honor. So it's good to have that slight interruption. But we're getting back to it. Where was I? Yes, the Amish and the draft. Lincoln granted them that draft exemption because he knew that life was more than war. And we see that God knows that too. Because we see in these exemptions the life he wants us to have. The life he wanted his people to have in the Holy Land. Is there any man who's built a house and has not dedicated? Is there any man who's planted a vineyard and has not tasted its fruit? Is there any man who's gotten engaged but not married? So God didn't want his people to just live in this land. No, he wanted them to improve it, to take joy in it, not just live in huts on the side or holes in the ground. No, he wants them to build houses good enough to dedicate and be proud of. He wants them not only to have agriculture and livestock to sustain themselves. No, he wants these luxury products. He wants wine. He wants olive oil, these things that make life so much better. Ask my mom and she will tell you life is better with wine. And God says that too. And is there any man who is betrothed to wife and have not taken her? I was once on a call for you. I think it was some nonsense of my insurance. And the lady said, well, I read my Bible. I pray at home. Do I really need to go to church? And I said, yes, absolutely. From here, we can see not only that God wants us to have the holiest state of marriage and have joy from our spouse, God wants us to be together. He wants that glorious and beautiful community to come together and have the joy of Him, the joy of wine, the joy of a good built house, to have them together. So, this is the good life. This is what we should want. And it's inscribed on our hearts. Even the most ardent atheist wants this life. Even the most pious Christian wants this life. I once knew a Christian man, and he wanted this life. So he went to college and got a very good job. I think it paid like $200,000 a year enough to buy a cardboard box on the side of the road in Los Angeles. But he got that really good job and required lots of hours for him. And so he worked. He worked those hours. He put in hard work because he knew hard work is pleasing to God. And so he worked late once again. And the next week he worked late a few more days. And then a few more days. And then a few more days. And a few more hours. And a few more days gone to his job. Until one day he looked up at the clock and realized, I don't know when I'm supposed to go home. This life that he worked so hard for, to provide for his loved ones, for his fiance, for his mom, for his friends, he couldn't have that life because he'd been consumed by work. But God calls us to more. We can see here that God calls us to not just life, but life abundantly. Life well lived. And he gives us that life. Not by our own works, but by his. And thank God he does. So those are the draft exemptions. Though this is the life that God wants us to lead. But he hasn't got to the most important draft exemption yet. We read in verses 8 and 9. And the officer shall speak to the people and say, is there any man who is spiritual and faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own. And when the officers have finished speaking to the people, then the commander shall be appointed at the head of the people. So, does God want you to have faith? Yes? Yes! Say it. Go back to me. Yes. Does God want you to have faith?
Yes!
Does God want you to have faith?
Yes!
Oh, I missed that. It's good to have a kid. But yes, God wants us to have faith. So here we see him make that faith easier to have. It doesn't feel like it so often, but God does not tempt us to go over from there. So here he asks those who are faint-hearted and fearful to go, so that those who do have faith may be strong in it, may be brave. So going back to soldiers versus warriors, you know the difference between a soldier and a warrior? A warrior is braver than a soldier. That sounds strange, doesn't it? But a warrior has to be brave, because his bravery alone is what shall save his life, is what he fuels himself with in the battle, so he knows he has to have that bravery in such great supply. And soldiers don't have to have that bravery. I know I didn't as a soldier. My bravery failed so many times. My faith failed so many times. But I know there was someone to my right. There was someone to my left. I know that there were those brave around me that I could rely on, those faith around me that those I could rely on. Look to your right and your left now. Your faith is going to fail. So maybe a small bit, maybe a great bit. So thank God we are soldiers, not relying on our own faith to get us through hard times, but relying on the faith of the soldiers to our right and our left, fighting in that great phalanx of the Lord. So, another thing you might be thinking about, these are a lot of draft exemptions. You got guys who have houses, you got guys who are engaged, you got guys who haven't had olive oil or wine getting cut loose, and now you have guys who are afraid getting cut loose. This army is small. It's not only that the army they face is big, it's that theirs is small. It's not only that the army they face has horses and chariots, these great weapons of wars, it's that so many of their brethren have been cut loose. Why does God do this? God does this so we rely on him. Remember what he says. Your God is with you. He will give you the victory. So he makes the army small. He makes the crowd of his believers in this battle small so that they rely on him, so that they trust in him over the strength of their own arms. If there were a million of us right now looking down at 1,000, do you think we would be very afraid? No. But what is there right now? Maybe 50, 60 of us? I didn't do a count. Maybe 50, 60 of us, and we're staring down Satan's legions, thousands upon millions of demons looking at us, but yet we have faith. Yet we are not afraid despite it all, because we know he has given us the victory. He has triumphed, that he has brought his people out of Egypt, that he has saved them from sin. Imagine what he can do for us now. So the soldiers have assembled. They've been talked to by the officers, by the priests, and now they march off to war. In verses 10 through 15. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. And if it responds to you peaceably and opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and serve you. But if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God gives it into your hands, you shall put all its nails to the sword. But the women's and the little ones, the livestock and everything else in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as plunder for yourselves, and you shall enjoy the spoils of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. So God wants soldiers, not warriors. He wants people who live to a standard, who trust in their commander. For me, it was Captain Griggs, a man who could run incredibly fast despite having a pot belly up to here. For us, Zach, it's Jesus. And so we trust in him. And so these Israelites trusted in him. They have rules of engagement, we call them in the military. ROI, how you should conduct yourself. For me, it was never fired unless fired upon, and they have to be wearing a certain uniform. Partly partly because it was training exercise, and partly because everyone in Afghanistan had a gun, just how they lived, just a fact of life. But they had these rules of engagement so that they act well, so things to look out for. This may sound like slavery, carrying off the people or making them serve you, but it's not. It's a different word. Having them do labor and serve you is actually a quite generous terms of peace and surrender. This could be anything from taking some of the city's goods, maybe they produced pottery, maybe they produced changes of clothing. Changes of clothing were a common thing to give in tribute at this time. Think of us conquering Afghanistan and saying, okay, give us all your pants. And this also means that the people in those cities would know the terms of surrender. If you know you're going to be treated well when you are taken captive, you are more likely to let yourself be taken captive. That's why we have the Geneva Conventions that say you must treat captives very nice, because then people are more likely to surrender to us as the just and poor. And God gives plunder. You shall take this plunder for yourselves, and you shall enjoy the spoils of your enemy, which the Lord your God has given you. Again, this is that life that God wants us to live. He wants us to not only survive, but thrive. So this plunder, these things that can prove their life, this labor, these artifacts, these changes of nice clothes, Armani suits maybe, he gives to us so that we can have that good life, but he reminds us who's giving it to us. That guy, he's giving it to us, not by the strength of our own hands, not by our good works, not by winning the battles for us, but because he won the battle. He defeated death and damnation for all of us, and he gives us that plunder to take. So that's cities far from the promised land. What about the cities in the promised land? We continue in verses 16 through 18. Whether the cities of these people that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance, you shall arrive, nothing that breathes, but shall devote them to complete destruction. The Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God. This is heavy stuff. This is extermination of entire nations, entire people groups. Thousands of people being put to the sword. Literal translation is put a sword in their mouth earlier. And here it's alive, nothing. Kill everyone. This is an extreme act of faith God is telling his people to carry out on his behalf. But he knows these people. He knows their abominable practice. He knows that they put children on altars and burn them alive for their gods. And he didn't want that for his people. He didn't want their good and pure worship to be corrupted by such disgusting practices. He didn't want them to fall to sin. So before it happens, remember, God is outside of time, so he bends and breaks it when he wants to. He comes to them, implores them. I know this will sound extreme. I know this sounds hard. It's going to be hard, but I beg you, kill these people before they damn you. Kill these people before they damn you. Do you remember Samson? That great warrior of the Bible who has so many beautiful artworks and comic books about him. That soldier for God who slaughtered armies with the jawbone of an ass. Who tore apart a lion with his bare hands. Do you remember how great he was? How mighty he was? Do you remember how he fell? Do you remember how he fell to lust to a woman whose people were taking the Holy Land for themselves? Do you remember how God asked him to have faith in him? Keep my law, don't cut your hair. And then he got drunk. Fell to lust, and he told that woman how to undo him. Do you remember Saul? The the great king, the wisest man to ever live, besides, of course, the boss. That wisest man to ever live. Do you remember how he had gardens filled with herbs throughout the world so that he could feed his court beautiful, delicious food? Do you remember how he built a great temple in God's name? Do you remember how he decided who got custody of that baby by trying to cut it in half? He was a wise man. And do you remember how God hated him? Do you remember that he was the first king that God despised? God did not despise Saul. He did not despise David, but he hated Saul because he married Hittites. He married Jebusites and Canaanites and Perizzites. He married these women, trying to secure the kingdom through marriage alliances by his own hand. He married them. He lost his faith in God, and this abominable practices crept into the worship of Israel by the wisest man's hand. And that wasn't the plan that God thought had been. Samson was meant to not only be a soldier, be a warrior, be a good judge, but be such a good judge that his people would never ask for a king because they knew they could trust and have faith in God like Samson did, because Samson was supposed to never break the covenant. He was supposed to be strong until the day he died and he fell. God saw it before it happened. You remember Solomon, who ruled over Israel at its height, took it to levels it had never seen before and never has seen, even to this day. The modern Republic of Israel is trying to get back to the level of King Solomon. He was supposed to be that great king who left a strong, united kingdom for them that could last forever. And it didn't. And it fractured and it broke right after he died. Split in half to Israel and Judah. That's not what God meant for him. This is why God is holding his people to a high standard. This is why he's telling them to do these things, to avoid these sins. Not because he doesn't want us to have fun, not because he's a killjoy. God, no, he doesn't want that. He wants us to have joy. He saw that move. But he knows that sin is not just something bad we do. Poison we take into us. It's something that corrupts us and makes us putrid and ugly. That poison can take so many things, so many ways. Perhaps you watch a movie and it has a scene of romance between two characters and makes you feel something. It makes chemicals in your brain go off in the way God wanted them to. So you seek out more scenes like that. But then they're not extreme enough. You find more and more and more extreme things to look at, just trying to get that high once again until you realize when you look at your fellow man, you don't see a person anymore. You see a thing, something to have pleasure taken from. So God comes to us and says, avoid these sins while you still can, before they poison and corrupt you, because I want you to be good and pure and holy. And yet, we do the sins. I've taken so much poison into my body. It reminds me of an Iranian saying, I've been bit by the snake so many times, there is no blood left in me, only poison. So thank God my blood doesn't redeem you. Thank God my blood isn't coming to us in the sacrament today. Thank God it's perfect blood that was shed on the cross for us, that redeems us, that brings us to new life, and that comes to us physically, literally, in this bread and this wine later on. Thank God. God is fighting the battle for his soldiers and winning that battle for his soldiers. So, what are they supposed to do during the fight? We move on to verses 19 through 20. We finish out strong. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat fruit from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field human, that they should be besieged by you? Only the trees that you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down, that you may build siege work against the city and that makes war with you until it falls. So God wants soldiers, not warriors. What's another thing that makes a soldier? A soldier stops. A soldier will one day lay down his sword. He will one day clean his rifle and turn it in. But a warrior doesn't. A warrior wanders from one battlefield to another. From one scene of bloodshed to another, he goes seeking that high of warfare, and he never stops fighting until eventually the sword he wields takes his life too. Those who live by the sword die by the sword. But a soldier stops. A soldier knows that one day this war will end. It may not seem like it at the time, but one day the struggle will end. So God says, trying to save us once again, don't sin. My creation is good. Remember when he looked out at the world and he saw the oceans with the perfect tint of green, the kind of green and blue only a master artist could perfect. When he looked out at the mountains and saw their cracks and crags, each one lovingly inscribed by the work of his hand, how he looked over creation, and like a satisfied artist said, it was very good. That is what he does here. My creation is good. My creation is in my image, so don't destroy it. Do not destroy these fruit trees. An olive tree can produce fruit for 125 years. It's a long time. So when you cut down that tree, you're not only preventing yourself from getting olives, but you're preventing your grandchildren and their grandchildren from getting those olives, from partaking of the glorious fruits of the land, all because you are so short-sighted, all you can see is wood and not fruit. So, don't cut down trees. I cut down so many trees. So many trees in our lives we have cut down for short-term gain. Perhaps it's a relationship. Perhaps someone comes to you one day and says, you know, you're really dumb, and so you hate them. And so you cut them out of your life, but they're cutting down that fruit tree. So you block them, delete their numbers, and do whatever it takes to get them out of your life, and they're gone from you. And one day you look back over the arc of your life, and you remember, I was the only Christian in their life. I was the only person showing them the light of God when they needed it the most. And now I don't know what happened to them. I cut them out. Are they dead now? Are they damned now? Don't cut down the trees anymore. I implore you, don't sacrifice for short-term gains. And the long-term gain is worth it. The long-term gain is not only the Holy Land, it is the holiest of holy lands. It is the new creation, the world made new and right, unbroken. And like soldiers, we march off to that new promised land. And like good soldiers, we rely on our commanders because they have won the battle for us. God has won the battle for us so that we can take these fruits. We can plant, we can not only have the fruit of the vineyard, the fruit of the olive tree, but have it in such abundance. Good soldiers, I implore you, keep marching. Not because you'll win the battle, because the battle has been won for you. And now may the grace of God, which surpasses all understanding, keep and guard you in your hearts and your minds, to life everlasting.